Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. My name is Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Our guest today is horse handicapper Barry Meadow, talking about his new book, The Skeptical Handicapper, Using Data and Brains to Win at the Racetrack. Barry Meadow, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Thank you. Nice to be here, Bob and Richard.
Good to have you back. The last time you were on was in 2013 discussing your book, Blackjack Autumn, which is about you traveling to and playing at every casino in Nevada that offered live blackjack. As a general rule, blackjack players are not particularly knowledgeable about horse racing with an edge. Without discussing your current book yet, what makes you qualified to write a book about winning at the racetrack?
Well, both blackjack players and professional horse players are always looking for an edge. That's the key to success in any kind of gambling game. And I did like blackjack, and of course I spent a lot of time playing the horses. I spent 5 years playing the harness races full-time, and then more than 20 years playing the thoroughbreds full-time. And there isn't much that I haven't seen or experienced at the racetrack, and that includes winning six-figure pick-sixes, to having a sure winner duck into the rail with 10 yards to go, to mismarking a ticket and winning an extra $40,000 once, to to getting disqualified off the most ticky-tack foul imaginable with a ton of money on it. So I've been there and done that. I've studied the factors that go into winning, and fortunately I was able to work with Ken Massa, who did the computer work for the Skeptical Handicapper, so we could quantify a lot of the factors that make for successful handicapping.
What kind of writing?
Go ahead, Bob.
Go ahead, Richard. What kind of
writing? I was just going to ask you about who Ken Massa is. Is he with Daily Racing Form?
No, Ken has a company called Handicapping Technology and Research, HTR, and he's been doing surveys, the computer surveys, of course, since 1993, and he's well known for being extremely diligent and even reporting stuff that is not successful, because that's just as important as stuff that is successful. So he's a computer expert, and we went over a lot of the surveys that we wanted to check. We figured out how to do it, and we worked together to do a lot of the surveys that are printed in the book.
So how much data was analyzed to come to the conclusions that you have in your book?
We looked at every race that was run in the U.S. and Canada from 2014 through 2017, which is more than 168,000 races. And for many of the angles we checked, we tallied the results of tens of thousands of races. So it's pretty comprehensive. So if we're looking at class drops and we're looking at horses with big wins, we looked at every single horse who met those qualifications over that 4-year period.
Uh-huh. Although, if you slice and dice it enough, you can get to too small a sample, like looking for maiden fillies with a star, right, a white star on their chest.
We didn't want to get involved with horses that won 7 furlong races and his name began with a T, who raced only on Thursdays. We wanted to look at factors which are numerous, and when something came up with, 20 plays over 100,000 races, we didn't do anything with that. Most of the stuff we printed involves thousands of races and very often tens of thousands of races.
And, for people who are always looking for the easy the easy answer, it seems like the book really was very good at identifying things that do not work as opposed to things that do. Is that a fair assessment?
I think so, because it's just as important to know what does not work. For example, let's say you're trying to get the best speed figure you can. Well, everybody's got speed figures, and any survey that we did involving high speed figures always had a lot of winners, and then they paid nothing, so there wasn't any money to be made. So we don't want to look at stuff that's obvious that people already know about. We're looking for stuff that's a little bit more either difficult to find or takes a little bit of work. For example, we found that workouts are a lot more important than people think. Having good workouts, long workouts, recent workouts seem to be a lot more important than who got the high figure. Things like early speed, but not necessarily early speed last race, just having the fastest first quarter in the race at any point in the past performances. So got more winners than trying to figure out some kind of algorithm to predict who's going to be in front. So we're looking for stuff that people use to see if they're overused, and maybe some stuff that people didn't use enough. And that's, we report the results, good or bad. And there's a lot of stuff, of course, that people don't know. I'll give you a simple example. 2-year-old debut winners are more likely to win if they're born in January than if they're born in May or June. And it's something you may not think about because it's one little parenthesis on the racing form, but it's something that should count. So, and a lot of stuff we discovered that was brand new. For example, the fact that blinkers off are much more effective than blinkers on. In a lot of the stuff we studied, it was almost a 10% difference as far as the ROI. So it was a search for what works and what doesn't work, and maybe how you can tweak stuff to make it even better.
So the data you collected was just this huge number of races over a five-year recent period. Now, do you expect that data to become obsolete? Would it still be valid in 10 years where all the current horses may still be alive, but they're not going to be racing anymore?
Well, most of the factors remain pretty consistent over the years. In that class droppers win more than class risers. Horses that finished second last time do better than horses that finished eighth. A lot of the factors we looked at have been pretty consistent, even going back 15, 20, 25 years. The only difference now is the prices seem to be a little less, and that seems to be because of a lot of these computer players who can do this analysis, and they've wound up pounding the horses that have obvious good factors to them. But as far as the data itself, I doubt it's going to change that much. Sure, it's something that maybe worked for 1,000 races this time may not work for the next 1,000, and vice versa. Something that failed for 1,000 might work. But as far as the large factors, I don't see that there's going to be that much of a difference going forward. Horses are still horses, and they do what they do.
What kind of questions can handicappers ask and find the answers to in your book?
Well, we've got dozens and dozens of surveys. What happens to a maiden if he breaks his maiden as a first-time starter? What happens to horses that break maidens in a maiden claim, or what do they do in the next start? What about horses that were claimed? How do they do in the next start and the start afterwards? Does it matter what type of race they were claimed from? Does it matter what kind of trainer picked the horse up? Does it matter if they have an apprentice jockey or a regular jockey? Do they do better in dirt sprints or distance races? So a lot of the stuff that we looked at, for example, we looked at Quickly Told Me, is horses that have raced a race one day and then come back within 10 days to race again. And if they won the last race, they would virtually break even. But if they finished in the back in that last race, boy, they did way worse than the track tape. Factors like that. So we took a factor, and then we looked at it through a whole bunch of different lenses to see what we could figure out. Any question pretty much that somebody has about handicapping, we hope that we've been able to answer it in this book.
Are these questions the reader can ask by searching, or is it you have had to have already addressed that particular question using the data for the reader to get the answer to it?
Well, we've divided this into four main sections. We've got class, condition, circumstances, and connections. So if you know what you want to look up, you just look in that section. Let's say you wanted to look on the class section, and you wanted to look at first-time starter favorites in maiden special weights versus maiden claimers. You just go to that chapter on class, you look up, you find the chart, and you see by looking at the chart that the favorites in maiden special races, they had an ROI of 84, and in maiden claimers, the favorites only had an ROI of 74, which means that maiden claiming favorites, first-time starters, are much better bet against than straight maidens. So each of the factors you might ask is in a particular chapter.
So what kind of advice do you have for the guy who wants to get into handicapping, who wants to get into horse racing?
Well, the first thing I would ask him is how serious do you want to be, because the more serious you are, the more work you're going to have to do. For example, I watched every single replay in Northern and Southern California for more than 20 years, and I watched it very, very carefully, not just looking for trouble, but for looking at why is this horse in this particular position? Does he look comfortable? Does he look better going inside or outside? What's the pace of the race? Things like that. And a lot of people don't want to do the work, but at the very least, you need to figure out why horses win and lose races. The best way to do that is watching replays. The next best way to do that is studying the charts. And if you don't do either of those, it makes it difficult when you're looking at just a list of past performances to see why that horse did what he did. Because horses are like humans. They do their best when they have their own steady rhythm and they're in the situations that they like. And for one horse, that might be on the lead without any pressure. For another horse, it might be sitting behind duelers. Another horse, it might be just sitting in the back minding his own business. You have to know what each horse likes, then you match him up to who he's racing against that particular day, and that's how you can make your decisions. It's not just looking for who has a high number, because this is winning is based on change. If a horse ran the 73 last time, you got to figure out which of those two, let's say two horses did that, which of them is more likely to run the 83 this time, and which one of them will probably regress to a 63. And we ask a lot of questions to help answer that particular question. It's about understanding horse racing. And once you understand horse racing, a lot of stuff becomes obvious to you.
So horse racing, much like sports betting, you know, there were dedicated handicappers that I would call them pencil and paper guys who, you know, used to literally do their handicapping with pencil and paper. And when competent computer programmers came in, they really sort of became dominant in sports betting. And the same thing happened in horse racing. So is it still possible for the pencil and paper guy to actually beat horse racing?
Absolutely. You know, a couple of months ago, I had a discussion with a guy who's head of one of the largest computerized robotic wagering teams that bet millions and millions and millions of dollars, and they play every track in the country, and everything is done by computer. And I asked him, I said, what about the lone wolf, the guy who specializes in his own track? And he beat you? He says, absolutely. Because first of all, we don't even play to win. If we lose a percent or two or three, we make our money through the rebates. That guy can do things we can't. We can't know every single nuance about each local trainer. We can't watch every single replay and around the country and put those factors in. We can't know the real ins and outs of a particular track. We can do it on a grand scale, but we can't do it as effectively as a guy who does it himself. And I found, personally, I had some of my best years when the computer guys were having some of their best years. So the fact that people handicap with computer programs or there are teams that do a great job of handicapping doesn't mean the individual can't win, because an individual can do a lot of things. How can the computer look at body language of horses, which some handicappers can do? How can they look at warm-ups? How can they analyze workouts? They can't do it. Humans can do it. So humans have some advantage. Where computers work is that they're unemotional, and that helps them because they can just look at the data and make decisions from the data without having any emotional input. But a human can add some things that a computer can't. I mean, let's say a horse was wide on the turn last time. How wide was he? What did he look like when he was wide? Computer can't tell you that, but a human can. So, yes, there's plenty of room for humans to still make money, despite the fact that these days, nationwide, almost 20% of the handle is bet by these computer teams.
So that type of individual needs to specialize in just a small number of tracks that he has access to, it sounds like.
Well, there are players that use their own computer program to check tracks around the country, or they have their own particular specialties that they like. For example, maybe somebody just likes grass races, and so he's going to look at grass races around the country. Maybe somebody else concentrates on two-year-olds, and others concentrate just on tracks, just like I did. I just did Northern and Southern California when I was playing, so I really got to know those horses. I could pretty much tell you what numbers I had for them without even looking at the computer, because I knew those horses so well. And the computer guy playing every track in the country can't really do that. So I think there's still plenty of room for the lone wolf if he does his homework and does this diligently.
Now, the takeouts, you know, the house edge in horse racing is really huge compared to other forms of gambling. So how do you overcome that?
The takeout nationwide averages about 20% when you consider all the types of bets. And that's a big problem because that means you've got to be very, very careful in the races that you do bet, because if you just randomly bet, you're going to lose a lot of money. And unfortunately, too many players, they want to bet every race, and they don't have an edge in that particular race. And so they wind up losing the track take. Obviously, if you're playing a game like blackjack or even roulette, your takeout is a lot less. Of course, you're making more of those bets. Tracks, you may be only betting every 15 minutes or half an hour or so if you do one or two tracks. But that's a serious problem to overcome. That's why you got to be very careful. You can't take 3-1 on a horse that's supposed to be 5-1. And you have to do the work to know what these horses are supposed to be. You have to have a good feel for what a price is on a horse, not just who might win the race. Because who might win the race is just one part of the equation. You got to be able to get your price. And with the takeout so high, that's a problem. Now, there are ways to overcome that. For example, you can play pick sixes and pick fives when there's carryover, so there's extra free money in the pool. You can play on mandatory days where they have to give out the pool, no matter what kind of carryover there is, and even if nobody has all six, for example. You can play tournaments where there's less of a takeout. You can play some of the promotions that some of these ADWs have. And, of course, getting rebates is crucial for somebody that wants to do this seriously, which means they may have to make a bunch of calls to various rebate places, see what places they're eligible to play at and which tracks they take and how much of a rebate you get on particular types of bets, because you're not going to get the same rebate playing Penn National Trifecta. You're going to get a giant rebate. Playing Santa Anita to win, you're going to get a very, very tiny rebate. And these are all ways of cutting the takeout down. But mostly it's about being careful and picking your spots.
So like a blackjack player, only playing the 3-2 game, not going to the 6-5 game. And
right, you don't want to make things worse. There are some states with 25% takeouts on some of these pick fives. There are others where the takeout 12%. So if when in doubt, they'll play the lower takeout, and that can be researched. You go to the Horse Players Association of North America. They have a website that tracks the current takeouts of every track for every bet. Or you can just simply call the tracks you're interested in and ask the mutual department what's the takeout on so-and-so. It would be nice if tracks put the takeouts on each bet on the website, but they're kind of like payday loan places. They don't like to put those giant interest rates in big letters for you. They want to make it difficult for you to find. But that's part of it, is searching for the bets with a lower takeout. It's certainly easier to beat a bet that's got a 15% takeout than one that's got a 25% takeout.
When you say lone wolf earlier, how often does it work that you have a partnership with a buddy you trust? Looking at replays for every race in California seems like a really time-consuming thing, especially if you're going to the track as well.
Well, there are teams where, for example, one person will do track A, the other person will do track B. But you have to make sure that you're doing it, that both people are equally committed. It's like having a family business. If one person is not as committed or doesn't have enough money, then you got a problem. But if both people are equally all in, then you can certainly divide the workload. Maybe somebody does grass, somebody else does dirt, somebody does routes, somebody does sprints, somebody does the northern track, somebody does the southern track. So it's possible if maybe you both do numbers and then you compare. Maybe one guy is doing bias notes and somebody else is keeping trainer stats. So you can certainly work with partners to do this if you have confidence that your partner is doing the job.
Have you successfully found partners through the years, or generally is it work better for you to be the lone wolf?
Well, when I first started playing, I did the handicapping, and I had one partner. Once I had two partners, and we put in pick sixes so we could play bigger tickets. But as far as the handicapping, I've never worked with partners. And one reason, I'd rather do all the work myself because I know exactly what I've done. I know how to watch races. I know how to do numbers. And if you've got, it's kind of like too many cooks spoil the broth kind of thing. It certainly doesn't hurt to ask a buddy you respect his opinion of a particular race, but to divide the workload, you got to be very confident they're going to do as good a work as you're going to do.
So you have been known as a writer about horse racing for a long, long time, but I think your last horse racing book was 30 years ago or something. Why? Yeah. I mean, you wrote Blackjack Autumn in between, but why so long?
The last book was Money Secrets of the Racetrack, of which the original version came out in 1988. But I don't have to update that because math is still math. 2 and 2 is still 4. That was just on betting. That was not on handicapping. And frankly, I was just too busy. I had a newsletter I put out for 7 years, which had a lot of statistical stuff in it. But I was gambling every day, and that takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of time because you got to watch the replays and read the workout reports and study each race carefully because you got to handicap them to see what you might learn about that race. And I did numbers on every single horse, so I had to do all my numbers. And sometimes I did stuff on trainers and other stuff. So there was a lot of work involved in doing the full-time gambling. And to put the time in to do a book besides, I just didn't have the time. After I retired, then I said, okay, well, let me travel around a bit and enjoy myself, and then I think I'll work on a handicapping book to bring in a lot of the stuff that I worked on that I didn't see in books, and also to do it from a statistical point of view, because a lot of books on handicapping are people's experiences and people's opinions about things, and I like opinions that are based in facts, not just anecdotes and stories. So while I don't have a lot of wonderful stories in the book, I purposely did that so I could concentrate on the data, because that's where you learn exactly why a horse wins a race and why a horse doesn't win a race, what types of horses are good to follow, what types of horses are not so good to follow. I wanted to research that in such a way that people could see the stuff in the charts very easily and say, oh, yeah, that makes sense. So I didn't write it in a colorful, you know, there's no Damon Runyon characters and no wonderful stories about great scores I made. You could say, oh, what a great guy. No, there's none of that. It's more, let's get down to the facts, let's get down to business and figure out how to win.
You know, it's weird, though, because you walk a fine line here, because on the one hand, there's all this data, but you're also relying on things you see in the video, in the replay, which are hard to quantify. You know, you talk about how does the horse look when he ran wide on that turn, and does he look comfortable, and those kinds of things. You know, those all are kind of judgment things.
Right. That's why winning at the races is a combination of art and science. The science part is what computers can do and what research can do. The art part is figuring out what you can add as a skillful observer and as a skillful handicapper. Not everybody has the same handicapping talent. It's like playing baseball or anything else. Some people just have a better feel for the game. And what I wanted to describe in the book is some of the factors that help you get that feel, one of which is watching the replays very carefully, another of which is paying attention to workouts, another one is if you're at the track, seeing what each horse looks like, but basically just doing the work and not saying, okay, if it's just a shortcut, let me take 1 minute to handicap this race. Well, 1 minute is not going to get you any money doing this. It might make for a nice afternoon with your buddies, but if you're going to do this seriously, you're going to have to do some work. And some of that work is doing the research. I mean, think of all the people that don't even bother looking up pedigree numbers or trainer stats. And the trainer is one of the most important factors in handicapping. So you have to know what kind of work the trainer does in different categories. And luckily, the Racing Forms Formulator is very good for that. But there are certainly other sources as well, because you have to know what the trainer is like in this particular situation. And the players that don't do that, they're going to get beaten by the players that do.
Well, it reminds me very much of poker, where you have a lot of math, you know, calculating pot odds and things like that. But at the same time, there's a lot of it that is totally subjective. And the danger is that you think you have an edge, but you actually don't. And deciding, I think that a horse looks happy or whatever, or fit, or but not, you know. So it's a tricky line to walk.
That's exactly why you keep records, because let's say that you believe you're very good at exactas, and you check all the exact bets you made for the year and you lost 23%, well, you're not that good. Well, all of us like to think we're better at something than we really are. And that's why record keeping is so important, because then you could see, well, what am I doing well? What am I not doing well? What kind of races am I having trouble with? What kind of bets am I making where the horse didn't went off at 2-1 and didn't run a yard? You have to study and observe your results and learn from them, not just write them down, but learn from them as well, so that you can make changes in your approach and say, okay, that looks like that's a promising area to go through. Oh, you know what? I overrated that jockey. That jockey's not as good as I thought. I underrated that trainer. That trainer's better than I thought. So you're constantly doing things and then looking at the results, and then you can be changing your opinion so that it's not just looking at data and it's not just having a feel. It's a combination of both.
Was there anything in all the results, in all the data, that really surprised you, that you didn't expect?
Well, the most surprising thing is how good the public is. It's just unbelievable, no matter what factors you look at, your favorites always do better than the long shots. When you think you've got something, the public is usually on top of it. Not that they're on top on everything, because they, as I said, they underrate workouts. Workouts are a lot more important, we found, than the public thinks. But they're very, very consistent. It's pretty amazing. I'll give you an example here. When a horse makes a new lifetime top, 3 out of 4 times he's going to run a lower number, a worse number the next time. But what if you bet every horse after he's made a new lifetime top? Well, there are 2 surveys involved here. One of them I did back in 2002 with Jim Cramer, 644,000 horses. With Ken Massey, we did one on 167,000 horses. Both of them, the average odds were 4-1. Both of them, the ROI was 0.76. That's pretty darn consistent, isn't it? So how good the public is, you have to respect the public. If they have a horse at 3-1, and you think the horse should be 12-1, you better take another look at that race. Maybe he shouldn't be 3-1, but he probably shouldn't be 12-1 either. So you have to respect the public, see what they're doing, and integrate what they're doing into what you're doing. I always thought my favorite plays were when I knew why the public was betting a horse big, and I knew that horse was not as good as what his past performance looked like. So I was always looking for a discrepancy between my opinion and the public's. But you have to respect the public. They're pretty tough.
So you were looking for when not to bet that horse, because the public was making a mistake.
I was looking for 2 things. I was looking for races where the public overbet a horse. That might mean some other horses are underbet in the race, or where there's a horse that's definitely underbet, and then I could bet on him or bet on the exact combinations. So I was looking for things a little bit differently from what the public looked like. For example, every race I try to plot out what the probable pace of the race was going to be. Who's likely to leave? What position are they likely to be in? Who can drop in from the outside, and who's going to get parked wide from the outside? Of course, which I originally learned from harness racing, but a lot of that carries over to the thoroughbreds as well. A lot of players never even look at that. They just look at numbers. They say, well, this horse had an 80, and the other horse had a 70, so the 80 should win. Well, maybe the 80 is a front runner, and he's got 2 stone front runners right inside him, and he's going to be forced wide into a fast fraction. He's not going to get there at all, even though he has a big number. Maybe another horse who's going to be minding his own business can drop in behind the speed, and he'll get a perfect trip. But if you don't try to analyze what the trips are going to be, you'll never know that. So trying to figure out what's going to happen in the race, to me, is a very important part of handicapping.
Before we continue talking to Barry Meadow about horse racing, we're going to take a few commercials. The South Point has more than 10,000 gains, returning more than 99%. This is more than anyone else has. In May, the promotion of the month is the $500,000 Swipe, Spin, and Win. On Mondays through Thursdays, beginning May 6th, play 300 points, either video poker or slots, between 3 a.m. and 10:30 p.m. Excuse me, 11:30 p.m., and you spin the virtual wheel. Prizes include free play up to $50, bonus points, reward cards, or food vouchers. After you play, stop by the kiosk and spin the wheel. Free play and bonus points go directly on your tab. You receive vouchers for food or resort cards. There will be a hot seat promotion on Memorial Day, Monday, May 27th. The exact details so far have not been announced. These are usually $30,000 promotion. Every 3 minutes, $100 is given away. At videopoker.com, it's the best place to play lots of games. If you sign up for a gold membership, $8.95 a month or $79.95 a year, this allows you to get correction on most of the games. The game of the week is multi-strike poker. This is a game where you play for four lines at the start, that is 20 coins. You play the first line. If you not score anything on that line, the game is over and you've lost the 20 coins. If you at least get your money back, you get to play the second line at double the amounts for no additional coin in. Win there and you play the next line at four times the payout. Win there and you play the top line for eight times the payout. Periodically, you receive a free ride before the draw, which means you move up to the next higher line, whether you score anything on the current line or not. A separate strategy is required for each line because success on a line gives you more than it does in a normal video poker game. In a normal video poker game, whether you win or lose on this hand has nothing to do with the next hand. Here, if you win, you get additional lines at double the payout at no additional bet. The Video Poker for Winners software includes this game and gives you the strategies required. On average, playing the multi-strike version of a game adds about 0.25% of the EV over the base games. They have five play multi-strike for quarters at South Point, where the best game, Jacks or Better, returns 99.79%. We are back with Barry Meadow talking about his book, The Skeptical Handicapper, Using Data and Brains to Win at the Racetrack. Barry, what would be the most common mistakes horse players make?
The biggest thing is they bet too many races. Some people, it's like going into a grocery store, you don't buy everything on the shelf. But I see people in the race books, oh, there's a race on TV, I got to go bet it. And when you bet a lot of races, it'd be like playing every hand in poker. Not every hand is worth playing, and not every race is worth playing. So the main thing I would say, cut down the number of races you play. Instead of betting $20 a race on 10 races, take your two best races and bet 100 each, and you have a chance to win some money. And you're actually betting where your opinion, where you have an opinion on the race, rather than you just want to have action. And along with that, I think players keep records. And if you keep records, you'll know exactly how you're doing. Of course, I think we know why most people don't want to keep records, because they're not winning. And they don't want to look at that. But that's the way you can tell how you're doing. So I would say that's the most important thing. People go for the obvious. That's a problem. Instead of waiting for when they have an advantage. The idea is when you find an edge, then you play. Otherwise, you're going to get ground down by the takeout. If you don't have an edge, there's no point playing that particular race. And your edge could be a lot of things. Could be you don't like the favorite. Could be you don't like the second choice, and you can play around them. It could be there's going to be a meltdown of pace horses, and you can bet a couple of the plotters that are in the back who have bad numbers to go by the really good horses that are going to be exhausted. So there's ways to get edges in races. You just have to do a little work to try to find them. You're not going to get it by bouncing out of your seat and betting every race.
My first question to people, you know, as gamblers, I'm sure we've all run into these people who tell us they win all the time, or, you know, I know how to play blackjack, whatever. But my first question is always, do you keep records? And of course they don't. Yeah, you find out right away whether somebody knows what they're talking about with that question.
Well, you know, if I want to look up how I did on place bets in 1994 at Santa Anita, I can hit a couple of buttons on my computer and get that information. One reason you do it is for the IRS. The other reason you do it is to not fool yourself. Because if you don't fool yourself and you say, well, I'm not doing that well, but I'm doing that other thing pretty well, now you know where to spend your time. You got to keep records because you always have to measure what you're doing if you want to do this in a successful way. If you just want to have action, go out there with your friends, sure, bet all the races, have some fun. I'm not saying don't do that. But if you're serious about winning, you got to take it seriously.
Now, Santa Anita was in the news quite a bit recently for all the wrong reasons. What happened there?
Well, a lot of horses died in a relatively short period of time, and they've been trying hard to figure out what the reason or reasons were, and there doesn't seem to be any. It seems to be kind of one of those outlier cancer cluster type things where some horses do die. I mean, horse racing is stressful on a horse. They have thin legs and they have big bodies. There was a very, very heavy rain for a couple of weeks, which might have affected the track to some extent. And then they had to seal the track often so horses can run on it. When you seal the track, the surface a little harder. The seal breaks up. Sometimes there's bad spots. But nobody has been able to really put a finger on exactly what happened, because some of it happened during training. Some of it happened on the turf course. Some days you had a whole ton of horses racing and training and nothing happened. So I think there's been a lot of scare about it, but I don't know that there's been any one particular reason why this happened other than just some bad luck all in a row.
The number of people betting on horse racing has been kind of steadily declining. What do you think? And a lot of these tracks now are much more interested in having a casino than they are in the horse racing. What do you think the future of horse racing is in the United States?
Well, I think right now things seem to have stabilized somewhat. At one point, handle was $15 billion a year. It's been about $11 billion for the last 3 or 4 years or so. It seems to have stabilized. Is it getting bigger? No, because there are a lot fewer horses now. There are fewer tracks. There are fewer racing days. There's less public interest. A lot of the newspapers don't cover it anymore except for the big days, the Kentucky Derby, Triple Crown, Breeders' Cup, things like that. But there's always going to be people that like to bet on horse races. And it's been, you know, horse racing has been around for a long, long, long time. I don't think it's going away anytime soon. But certainly there are going to be changes in it. And as far as the public is concerned, yeah, some of the things have been pretty good. You don't have to go out to the track if you don't want to. You can play from home these days. You have a choice of many, many types of bets. You can set your computer up, so you're not going to be shut out as you might be at the track. The tracks offer, some of these ADWs offer bonuses. You bet $100 on some random Thursday, there's an extra $10 in your account. So there are there's tournaments, there's all kinds of things that go on now, which I think are to the good for horse racing. And I think there's going to be some other changes as well. I think at some point they're going to be open sourcing of all the racetrack records, which right now you have to pay for the stuff. So I think that's going to be changing at some point. But there's certainly new things that go on. There are new ways to handicap. Timeform US is a product that's only been around a few years. The same thing with Optic EQ is another handicapping type thing. Trackmaster had something have something called a bubble capper. So there are all kinds of new ways to do handicapping. There are all kinds of better products to get information. So it's actually a pretty good time if you like information. There are not going to be as many races, and there's not going to be as many horses. A lot of the breeding farms have gone under. But it's not going to go away either, because people do like it, and people have liked it for a long, long time.
How good at computer programming do you have to be a successful horse bettor?
I say not at all. I don't know how to program a computer. I have no idea. I've used computers, you know, for database stuff. Like I have a list of every horse that raced to the track and my comments on him every time he raced. I set up a database for that. But as far as actual programming a computer or programming something to pick winners, I wouldn't know how to do that. Yes, it's a plus if you can do that, but you don't have to do that. And there are still some old-timers that have been doing this a long time that use paper and pencil and do just as well as the computer guys.
Other than your book, for players starting out, what other books should they consider to become a winning horse bettor?
Well, of course, they have to get my two books. They have to get The Skeptical Handicapper, Money Secrets on the Racetrack. But there are many other good books. There's Handicapping 101 by Brad Free, which is a good basic introduction. Any of the books by Dave Litvin, Mike Maloney's recent Betting with an Edge is a very good book. Some of the stuff, Six Secrets of Successful Players is another one. There are a lot of good handicapping books, and I think somebody starting off should start off by reading some of the general handicapping books, the stuff by Jim Quinn, and even going back to the old Ainsley books. There's some good ideas in that. So I would say start off by reading a few books, and then you'll start to figure things out, because some of them will say certain things. And say, well, I think pace, it does count. Yes. If you didn't know that, you'll be lost. Also, there are a lot of good things you can get now on the Internet. A lot of people are doing good work. I mean, today's Racing Digest here in Southern California does a great job of looking at a lot of different factors each day, and that's a good, very good teaching tool for learning what to look for when you're handicapping. So there's a lot of people doing good work. It's not like there's two people doing it and everybody else is an idiot. There's a lot of good stuff out there, and I think if people will just simply Google handicapping books, they'll find a bunch that are pretty darn good.
Horse racing has always had its touts where people will be glad to sell you their picks or even give you their picks. Do you consider this a nuisance, a problem, just part of the air we breathe? How do you consider this?
Well, think of it the same way you think of sports touts. The thing about horse racing is if I don't know anything about it, and I go to the track, let's say I go to a dog track, well, I'll pick up a tip sheet or something that has some information about it. But as far as touts, these days, it's not as bad as it used to be many, many years ago. These days, people use their own name. They sell their own picks. They often give you samples. They show you what they do, and then you decide if you want to do it. And a lot of them don't charge that much. It's usually anywhere you can buy picks for a million tracks. For $10 or $5 or maybe no more than $25. You don't have to spend a zillion dollars to do that. And if you want to get help from people that are doing some good work, there are certainly trip note services and things like that that you can get. As far as people coming up to you, at the track saying, hey, I got a good one and pay me, that I don't know if that even goes on anymore. That went on a long time ago. People now use their names. They make their own picks. They sell their picks. You decide if you want to spend the money. I don't see where it hurts anybody, but on the other hand, you have to look at from the point of view of the tout. He has to make his selections before the late scratches, before he's sure about the track conditions. He doesn't know what the odds are going to be. I mean, it's very, very difficult if you think you're going to follow a tout and make money. Hard to do it because he doesn't have all the information that the up-to-the-minute player will have. Just one scratch can change your race completely because the pace situation has all changed. A horse, it might be a good bet at 3-1 is a lousy bet at 6-5. So it's very hard to assume that a tout is going to be able to help you.
So what handicapping factors are overrated and which ones are underrated? You mentioned workouts overrated. Being underrated.
Yes, so I would say workouts are underrated. Things that are a little harder to get, pedigree, deep dive into what trainers do, how trainers think, setup of the race, what the pace flow of the race is likely to be. I've spent some time doing that. For some people, they can look at horses. They're very good at body language, and they can watch warm-ups and see if a horse is better or worse. Some people can interpret the workout sheets pretty well. But overrated, anything that's obvious, jockey win percentage. Well, yeah, the top jockeys get on the best horses. But interesting thing we found, we looked at every single favorite for those 4 years, and we compared the top jockeys with 20% wins or more versus the lower jockeys, under 10%, and the ROI was almost to the penny exactly the same. So I think basically jockeys, if they get good horses, they win a lot. If they don't, they don't. Whereas trainers have to work on things like placement of the horse, whether to race them long or short, grass or dirt, how much layoff to give them, how to train them. So trainers are much more important than jockeys. So I think jockeys are certainly overrated. High speed figures are overrated. Win percentages will give you wins, but they won't give you money. I'll give you an example. You take two horses. One of them won by 8 lengths last time. The other one lost by 8 lengths last time. What are they going to do next time they run? Well, the horse that won by 8 lengths is going to win twice as often as the other horse, but the ROI is exactly the same. So a lot of stuff that people look at in space, well, hey, there's a big number, he should do well. Unless you marry it to what the prices are, it's not really going to help you. So you're trying to find stuff that maybe takes a little bit of nuance.
So that goes back to the public being smart. The public will bet those horses accordingly, so the ROI ends up the same.
That's right. If you look at where a horse finished last time, a horse that finished fifth last time versus a horse that finished second last time, the ROI is just about identical. So the public can zero in on a lot of factors, and what you want to do is not use the obvious stuff that the public does, at least to use it as far as betting. You can use it as far as handicap, and obviously a horse that is coming off three races where he ran 91s is going to be better than a horse that ran three races when he came off 71s. But is that going to make you money? You got to look for stuff that's going to make you money, which means looking at the stuff just a little bit differently from what the from what the public does, because the public is going to lose a certain amount, and you don't want to lose that amount. You want to win.
So the public is really good at pricing the horses to win. Are they as good at pricing the exacta or the trifecta? Things like
yes,
that.
Yes, they are. One reason is that you have computer guys that are looking at all those prices and looking to see which combinations might be underbet or overbet. And so generally speaking, if a horse is 2-1 in the win pool, he's probably somewhere around 2-1 in the exactas too. He's not going to be 6-1. There's not going to be that much of a difference. All the years I played, I checked the exacta prices and the win prices and the double prices, and there was very little difference as far as if a horse was 3-1 in the double, it was probably 3-1 to win. Not always, but most of the time. Public is just very, very good. So you have to look for things where you believe the public has made a mistake, and they make mistakes all the time. They bet a horse that the situation is not good for the horse. The who's likely to be where is not going to be helpful to his cause, even though he's got big numbers. They bet him because he's got big numbers. Or they bet a horse that just got claimed off a good trainer to a bad trainer. Well, he's not the same horse anymore. A bad trainer's had a chance to work his non-magic. So you got to take that into effect. So you're looking for things where you believe the public has made an error, and if you do that often enough, you're not going to find horses that should be, 2-1 going off at 30-1, but you might find horses that should be 2-1 going off at 7-2. That's where you can make some money.
Is there a difference in how smart the public is betting winners as opposed to show horses a place?
Well, I bet the place and show. One reason I bet the place and show when I was playing was the more action you have, the more, better rebate deals you're going to get. But what I did is I always figured what was the percentage of the place and show pool for that particular horse, not just what his win odds were. So I had little charts I used, and you can't make tons of money betting place and show, but, you shouldn't lose tons of money betting place and show either. You're going to cash more than if you just play to win. But if you're going to bet a 23-1 shot, you're probably not going to make much money betting them to show. If you're going to bet a 6-5 shot, it's a different deal. Maybe he's underbet the show. So I try to look at as many pools as possible before I made my decision about what to bet. And I always try to bet at the last possible second, which more and more people can do now because of computers and, speed dial.
When you actually, I've not been in the track in years, do you actually go to the window to manually place your bet, in which case you get at the back of the line? It can be, you have no idea if you're going to be up there or just before the window closes.
What I did in the days when you had to play at the track, which was many years ago, I would go to the track and I would find a window where I could see the TV monitors so I could look at the monitor as long, as late as possible. Some of the windows are not, you can't see any TV with the prices on them. I stayed away from those windows. I went to where I could actually see the stuff. And then, of course, eventually I went to simulcast places and eventually playing from home where I have the screens right up on my computer so I can see everything right till the last second.
Well, also, nowadays in many tracks, you can actually bet on your phone while you're at the track. So you can.
Well, I remember that. I remember one time at Santa Anita, I got to the track. I saw it plenty of time, but it was one of those big race days, and there were gigantic lines at the windows, and the lines were still gigantic with 3 2-minutes to post. And I went over to a pay phone. Remember those days, pay phones? There was one time you couldn't even use a pay phone. Eventually they let you use pay phones. So I go into a pay phone. I call my bookmaker because I didn't want to wait on the line because I couldn't get in. So to avoid shutouts, that was that was what you had to do. But now most places it's not really a big problem because the crowds at the track are fewer. 90% of the money is bet off track. And last year, for the first time, less than $1 billion was bet on track. All that rest of that $11 billion was bet off track. So there are fewer people, which means the lines are shorter, which means it's easier to bet.
What would be the advantages and disadvantages of being at the track compared to betting at home? Are there still advantages? Are there advantages both ways?
Yeah, if you're a serious player and you're going to play every day and really learn the stuff, if you're at the track, you have the advantage of watching the horses in the paddock and watching them in the warm-ups, which for some people they can do that and that increases their bottom line. That was never my thing. I always played, you know, from my home or from a simulcast place. But if that's your forte, that's certainly a good thing. And if you're at the track, you know, you get to talk to people, and maybe there are some people with good opinions that you might want to chat with, whereas if you're by yourself, that's not going to happen. And the whole ambience of being at the racetrack and seeing the horses live is a beautiful thing. What happens if a horse breaks out of the gate before the race starts? And at the track, you'll know that, whereas if you're maybe at home, you won't know that. What if 1A is scratched at the last second and you're left with horse number one? Well, at the track, you'll know that, but maybe if you're not paying attention and you're in a simulcast place, you won't. So it's a little bit easier to stay concentrated at the track unless you're chatting with your buddies the whole time. And then if that happens, invariably, your best bet of the day is the one you were busy explaining why gray horses are allowed to race. Oops, the race just went off. My 6-to-1 shot just won. Silly me. So you still got to concentrate when you're at the track.
So the Kentucky Derby is coming up soon. Is there anything we should know about it?
Other than there's going to be a lot of horses and they all want to win, that's about all I can tell you. People every year used to ask me who I like in the Derby. I don't know. There's 20 horses coming from a bunch of different tracks. Who knows how they're going to take to the service. It's a distance none of them have ever run before. I have no idea. I've never had an idea. Even the day I went to one Kentucky Derby, I had no idea. I bet $2 on Holy Bull just to give me some activity in the rain. I like to stick with horses I know and have an edge on. If I don't have an edge, in Kentucky Derby, it's kind of hard to have an edge because you have so many people giving seminars, picks, watching all the replays, studying all the speed and pace numbers. Kentucky Derby is a difficult race to have much of an edge. It's a good race to watch and enjoy the sport, and I always watch it every year. But I'm not, never been a gambler on it.
Makes sense.
Well, I look for an edge. When I have an edge, I play. No edge, let other people play.
That's kind of the Super Bowl of horse racing. And, you know, for a lot, other than prop bets, you know, it's the hardest to get an edge on the point spread.
There is one good thing, though, in that when you're playing the horses, you're playing other players. When you're playing basketball, for example, you're playing a bookmaker's solid line. So even though the takeout is much higher at the horses, the public is more likely to make a mistake than a series of professional bookmakers. So that's where your advantage is. When you see the public has bet a horse, why did they bet this? Oh, I know why they bet that horse. Well, that was a bad reason. Maybe there's something else I can bet in the race.
Other than Amazon.com, where can we get your books?
They can go right to my website, which is trpublishing.com. Always easy to remember because TR stands for Thoroughbred Racing. So they go to trpublishing.com. There's an order form and information right on the website. And anybody who orders the book directly from me, I will autograph the book for them. And shipping is free, just like it is on Amazon. So they can do that, and my phone number's on there, so they can call me if they want as well, and the books normally go out every day.
And are you on Twitter?
No, I've stayed away. I'm not on Facegram or Insta, Twitter, any of that stuff.
Okay.
Do you know how much time I save every day compared with a lot of people?
Oh, yeah, I know.
That's how I was able to write a 445-page book. I had more time because I wasn't on that stuff.
Yep, I get it.
I'm in the Barry Meadows School of Insta Twitter. So, thank you, Barry. This has been very educational. We're very happy that you're on the show. Thank you.
And thank you very much. I appreciate the time again.
Richard, thank you. Go out and hit lots of royal flushes, everybody. Good day.